Hello and welcome to another edition of Third Degree Burn. I'm your host, Kirk Greenfield, and today we are dealing with Alpha Flights number 15 and 16 in our continuing index show. I'm joined by our local expert panel, starting with Tim Elliott.
Hello.
And we have Nigel Smink.
Hello.
And there's a possibility that we'll be joined by a couple of others that had some prior commitments, but we'll see if they join along the way. Well, we've certainly been in for a shock as we discovered that Guardian not only was apparently consumed at the end of 12, but they've had a funeral for him in 13. And much to many of the fans' surprise, he didn't come back. So he appears to be really and truly dead. As the Munchkins say from Munchkinland, I have examined her and she is really and truly, truly dead. Okay, so we're moving on now, and we've started a three-part arc. I'm going to say it's three parts because it's going to finish up tonight, starting in 14, and now we're going to do 15 and 16 that will really develop the story considerably and also advance some subplots. Does anybody have any Alpha Flight news to share? I know it's kind of hard considering how old this series is, but anything to share, Burn-related, before we jump in?
Not really. Well, the only thing that's really been in the news is his winning of the Harvey Award.
Yes. I've seen a couple of photos on the internet, a little gold statue. That must be something he's very proud of. The recognition is well-deserved.
That's that Harvey? Did Harvey Kurtzman? Harvey Kurtz?
Is that, I want to say named you're after? Right. Named after the artist creator from Mad Magazine.
That's what I thought, Mad Magazine.
That's perhaps his biggest, most prominent achievement that he's recognized for, although I'm certain there are other things, and I'm unfamiliar with his background, so I can't say much more than that. But yeah, it is a recognized industry award, and tip of the hat to John Byrne for being recognized for that.
What's the
go ahead.
What's the other award? From the creator of the Spirit, it's the Will Eisner. Will, is it the Eisner Award?
I don't know.
There is another award like that that's comic related.
And there's also the Eagle Awards, as we know from the early New X-Men books. They won an Eagle Award of recognition for, I think, the series. That's not a creator, but
I've never heard that.
But an award to a title.
Yeah, they got it twice, I think.
Is that for writing or drawing or just overall?
I'm going to say, I think it's more for the book itself, yes. You know, yeah.
I think it's overall. I remember seeing the emblem on, don't hold my feet to the fire here, but I think it was X-Men 131. No, 134.
That was the second. So. Yeah, that was the second time they got it.
Oh, really?
There's an emblem the same on, I think it's 118.
There you
go. The submergence of Japan. That was the first time he got it, yeah.
So it's kind of the book overall. I'm looking, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's what it says there? It's a UK-based comics award.
Yes, Eagles Comics.
Yeah. Mm. There's also one that's called the Inkpot Award. I think that's obvious for inkers, I think.
Yeah. There are more than I had realized. You're right. I've heard of that, too.
Yeah.
Well, shall we get into number 15? I understand that, Nigel, you have the synopsis for 15. Would you like to begin?
I do, yes. Let's get into it then with Alpha Flight number 15, release date of 17th of July, 1984, cover dated October of 1984. The team on this one, as usual, writer-penciler John Byrne. Now, new inker from this issue, Bob Wiercheck. Colorist, Andy Yanchus, or Yankus. Letterer, Rick Parker. Editors, Denny O'Neill and Linda Grant. And editor-in-chief, of course, Jim Shooter. Other works from Byrne that were available October of 84. There's one or two things here, actually. So, Epic Illustrated number 26, which carries the first chapter of the last Galactus story. So, of course, Bernie's writer and artist on that. Fantastic Four, issue 271. So he's writer and artist on that. I believe this is a reprint of Indiana Jones number one, which originally came out in 82. I can't find anything else that's any different. So I think it must have been a reprint that they were putting out. So, of course, he worked on that, and I think he scripted it as well. And finally, Superman 400. It was an anniversary issue, and it took me ages to find what he'd actually done on it. there's like seven or eight different stories in this issue. And I went through them all, and I'm thinking, well, there's no way where it says John Byrne. And then right at the bottom, it said, you know, there were posters by, and he apparently did a poster picture. So on one of the pages, there's a Superman drawing from John Byrne. And that's why they mentioned that one. And then, of course, this issue, which is called Blind Date. And as Kirk's already said, it's carrying on from issue 14. So, the issue begins with Doug Thompson in his home, thinking about his imprisoned love, Anne McKenzie. She's recently escaped from prison and he is being implicated as an accomplice. His doorbell rings and he goes to check who it is, and he's surprised to find Anne outside his house. He quickly ushers her in and she explains to him that Anne McKenzie is not actually a real person and that she is in fact Snowbird of Alpha Flight. She tells him that she's been sent to Earth for a purpose that she can't reveal to him. He reveals to her in turn that he loves her. Meanwhile, Puck and Marina stand at the shore of Lake Ontario. They're there to investigate a string of murders. And due to the type of murders and how they happen, Puck seems to have an idea that the murderer, whoever that or whatever that might be, could be related to the same species as Marina, which is why he called her in. So Marina dives into the lake to begin hunting for the killer. After swimming around for a while, she comes across an underwater tunnel. And she has this feeling which urges her to enter in. And so she swims into the tunnel and it goes down and down into the depths of the earth, it seems. And she follows it all the way until she comes out in an underwater cave. She surfaces there and she starts to look around for something or someone, when suddenly she is startled by something. Back on the land, Aurora is waking up in her room. She feels that her Aurora persona has emerged over her Jean Marie persona, a fact that is verified by a look in the mirror to see her own reflection looking back at her. She decides to cut her hair short, hoping to lock away Jean Marie forever. Back on the shores of Lake Ontario, Puck is confronted by Marina, who has apparently gone feral again. Marina attacks, but Puck is able to use his agility to avoid her. as the two tussle, Namor the Submariner suddenly leaps out of the water, having followed Marina from Atlantis after she received the Alpha Flight call signal. See issue 14. Thinking that Puck is the aggressor, Namor attacks and knocks him out. Meanwhile, just outside Calgary, Alberta, Elizabeth, two young men, arrives at her father's medical clinic and demands to see Dr. Two Young Men. She seems unhappy to see him and states that he speaks to her only as Shaman, not as her father. Back in Toronto, a mystery man watches from the shore as Marina turns her attack on Namor. Namor appears to gain the upper hand. And as the now conscious Puck watches their fight, he is approached from behind by the mystery stranger, who renders him unconscious once again. As Namor holds Marina aloft, wondering what to do with her, she lashes out with her arm, temporarily blinding the Submariner, which allows the mystery man to approach and subdue him. The stranger then sheds his outer clothing to reveal himself as Master of the World. To be continued.
Nice.
Good job.
Denjing.
With appropriate nice. thunder cracking behind him.
Yes.
I posted a couple hours ago a picture on Facebook of, and I don't know why not, I never made the connection, but the Master of the World looks amazingly like Robert Delgado from
the actor, and I said
well, he played the master, this guy is the master.
I guess Burns is a fan, I had not thought of that. But what I was going to say is, when I saw him in the outfit he's got on here in this issue, he reminded me of Diablo, who from time to time has appeared in like ordinary clothing, if you like. And this is one look that he had. I can't remember if it was in an FF or an Avengers. But yeah, that picture near the end, about two pages from the end, where he's kind of looking from underneath the brim of that hat.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, oh yeah, he looks like Diablo.
I think you're right. I'm thinking that was probably in the Dragon Man two-parter in Avengers 41, 42.
Yeah, well, I did check that. And although he's wearing a similar hat, the rest of it, the jacket he was wearing in FF 35, it's not the same kind of jacket. This is more of a trench coat. Yeah.
Right.
It was a shorter jacket that he had on in the FF issue. But I think in Avengers, there was also a story with Dragon Man, and Diablo was in that. And I think he wore something more like this in that story. I might be wrong, but I seem to remember it.
Well, this is standard comic disguise. White brim hat and trench coat. True. I mean, how often did Ben Grimm wear that? Walk around in public.
But the look of his face as well, you know, I thought, oh, Diablo. Yeah. Yeah. But you're right. Also the master. Mm.
It's that little bit of white, the way he's got the white in the beard is exactly like Delgado in the Pertwee era. They kind of get rid of it when Anthony Aimley took over.
Roger Delgado was the master. Yes. Yeah, true. Mm-hmm.
Well, this issue does a lot of, this is a lot of setup. I mean, we had setup in the last two issues where we kind of had fallout from issue 12, you know, the death of Mac. And then we started this Puck and Marina story. And And we're going to kind of conclude that when the issue I cover, but this one, it's a lot of what Byrne does. He layers his stories. So one will kind of end and he's peppered in stuff while that story's going on. Then that story takes over and he's peppered in stuff. And then that story takes over.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
we're
yeah.
kind of getting follow up with Snowbird, more with, God, what's Michael T. Youngman's daughter's name?
Elizabeth.
Her, and she's fixing to play a big part in the book coming up. And then, of course, we still have more going on with Submariner and Marina and Puck and all that. So,
Yeah.
Well, I really like that technique. I think Byrne not only is a master of it, but it's smart marketing because you never give your readers a stopping point to drop off, but instead you're enticing them to pick up the next one and pick up the next one.
Well, to be honest,
that do come to an end or a stopping point where they change writers, it's an invitation for people to jump to the bolt off from books. And so I give him and or his editor a lot of credit for developing this technique.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, Kirk, to be honest, where have you seen this technique before in the past?
Oh, dear. Put me on the spot.
I didn't mean to. I thought you'd get this dead easy.
Well, Lee and Kirby, I would think, to some degree.
Yeah, I'm going
to
say.
When they began their stories, did it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought. Going back, this is what I liked about the Fantastic Four back in the Lee Kirby, when it got really, really good from like the 40s onwards.
Yes.
That's how their stories went. They kind of all overlapped with the different plots just to keep you, you know, buying it and engaged with everything that was happening.
Well, and it keeps you from, and it doesn't prevent the issue from being kind of a one and done. You could pick up an issue and still enjoy it because you get a story. I mean, granted, with this style, you are getting a lot of bits of story, but you don't. It keeps you from having to cram a bunch of stuff into one story. You can spread it out, and I think Byrne likes to tease people and just give little snippets. It may be an image, maybe something. He does it all the time, which does works out well. I think it does. It keeps you coming back because you want to. And it doesn't get so convoluted that it's paid off 30 issues later. You know, that was kind of my, I used to have that problem when I was reading Claremont. Sometimes his stuff would be so complicated and stuffed full of dialogue that when I got the next month's issue, I'd have to think, what happened last issue? And I'd have to go back and refresh myself to what happened.
Yeah. Too much info.
We'll point out one thing, and since you brought it up, Nigel, the Galactus trilogy, Fantastic Four 48, 49, 50, which is referred to as a trilogy, which the definition doesn't actually fit, but that's how it's referred to.
If
you take the page count and you look at where the story actually begins with the Silver Surfer all the way to the departure of Galactus, there's actually only about 40 pages between the three books. In other words, the story starts halfway through 48 and it ends more dramatically in the middle of 50. So it was a two-part story that in fact got slid into three. And there were some people who bitterly complained about collected stories or rather continued stories like that. And they must have gotten somebody's ear at Marvel, maybe the publisher, because after about two and a half years of this sort of continued story that just kept rolling and rolling that we all loved, Anita came down from on high saying, okay, no more continued stories. Done in one. That's all that our kiddies want. Which totally ignored the fact that they had adult readers and young adult readers that liked this. But the point was made, hey, if I'm fighting in Vietnam, I might get issue number 52, but I can't count on finding 53, and then maybe I'll find 55. So it's really not fair to us. Well, you know, I actually read a letter or two like that. And while my heart goes out to them that they had poor distribution in the military, what about the rest of us? You know?
Yeah, I'm going to say.
Well, it makes you want to, it makes you, when I first started reading comics, I kind of as an adult, I liked the fact that, especially with editor's notes, you would read something and it would say, hey, this happened back in issue whatever. Or it may even reference a totally different book. You may be reading the Hulk and it references something that happened to Thor. And it makes you want to go and seek out those issues.
Yeah.
Or you want to get the rest of the story. You know, how many times I've read a comic that I've read only that one. So you don't know what happened before. You don't know what happened after. And it makes you want to go out and seek those issues out. I kind of like it.
It's a change in style. It's a change in technique of writing more complex stories and writing for a different audience that can remember and manage that instead of being a done in one. I fold up the issue and I jam it in my back pocket and I may trade it to Bobby for his copy of Superman. It's a different approach. And I think that Kirby and Lee developed that as they realized that they had young adults that were not aging out and leaving Marvel and the Fantastic Four behind, but instead were invested in the developing character of Spider-Man and whatever else. So,
well, I think they knew they were also reaching the college market.
Yes.
And that was became obvious after, I think, during the late 60s that probably when Stan was touring more and giving talks and stuff, that they knew they were reaching an older audience. And I will say this, even though this is, it's not the same kind of decompressed storytelling that goes on now in current comics where it's kind of written for a trade. You can tell this is written to be collected in a trade. This is not, these are not, you know, really one story that they've expanded and stretched out over five issues. No, this is a lot going on. There's a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of going on. It's a very dense storytelling. And he's juggling a lot of, I mean, there's what, one, two, what, three stories going on in this? Possibly four?
At least. Four, yeah.
What'd you guys think of on, it's on pages 13, 14. We get kind of a, really a lot more information on Puck's background. It's when he's fighting Marina and he talks about bullfighting with Hemingway. Again, hinting that he's much older than he really is. And he's, to me, it's kind of Wolverine-like in that what's his mysterious past? He seems like he's been around longer than he could naturally, looking at his age. And he's done all these things. You know, he speaks, you know, it's like when we found out Wolverine spoke Japanese. It's this thing. It's like, well, we didn't know you spoke it. And he's like, well, you know, I was, that's from years ago. So
he never asked.
Yeah.
I thought that it gives you listening to his thoughts first and then, of course, the narration boxes. And he mentions, as you say, being in Spain with Hemingway. So you think, he's been around for quite a while, this guy.
Yeah, because that would have been, help me out, Kirk, that would have been what, 20s, 30s? When was Hemingway?
I'm not certain, but I would have guessed the 30s at least.
Yeah.
And then page 12, as you say, in his thoughts, he says, and I promised Guardian my killing days were over when I was paroled in the beta flight.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So he's killed someone. That, you know, it's like there's depth to this character that keeps revealing. I agree. It is, pardon the expression, it is like a mini Wolverine, but a man of mystery.
Well, we find out later when we cover my issue, we find out a little more about his background with other characters. I've always liked Puck because he's, I mean, it, which is odd that, I don't think Byrne ever intended to him to have any kind of superpowers. Now I know later it's revealed that he doesn't really have superpowers, but he is older, but it's an old book. We can reveal that. It's not Byrne that does this. And I can't remember who is writing the book. Is it,
Thoroughly forgettable.
It is.
And as a result, we don't have to cover it.
Yeah. But it's, you know, he's holding some kind of demon or something within him or something. And that's what causes him to that's what's causing him to be a dwarf. But it also is what's keeping him from from aging. So that's why he's so old. So if Byrne wasn't intending him to be any kind of a mutant or anything about him, why Byrne is hinting that he is much older than he is? So maybe Byrne had other ideas. I don't know.
Yeah. He's a time bandit.
Could be.
What'd you think of the cover?
I was just going to say the same. I like it. It's really spectacular. Yeah.
It's mainly a red cover. I'm reading the reprint in the trade paperbacks, so I trust that the coloring is pretty accurate to the original. But it's very dramatic with red, blue, and then brown at the bottom.
Yeah.
Pretty dramatic. You mentioned something. I'm going to skip ahead, turning the page to Snowbird's reveal to her significant other. I'll just use that term.
Duke.
And that she says, you know, actually, Anna was never a real construct, a real person, but a construct. Mm-hmm. You know what flashes through my head? It's like, gee, it's like Thor and Dr. Blake, Dr. Don Blake. Was Don Blake ever really a character, a person? And depending on who the writer is, that answer has been changed at different times into saying yes or no. But it's the same sort of vibe. Gee, we have a godlike figure that needs a more human persona to pass by or pass under. I saw that parallel.
Yeah.
I mean, you could run parallels to Clark Kent and Superman.
Except, that's true.
Except in this case, Snowbird is her true personality and Anne is her made up one. And I feel with Clark, it's Clark is who he really is. Superman is who he pretends to be, or, you know, that's his persona, his superhero persona. But, you know, at the core, he is really Clark Kent.
Right. One thing I never understood when I think about Superman, why everybody assumes that a superhero has a secret identity. It's like, why? Why would you assume that they are anything other than what you see? A costumed individual who has a code name. What would make you think that they had a secret identity, Lois, that you have to go uncover or that you have to expose? That's just that has never sat well with me.
Well, I mean, you can either see it as the way they explain it is, well, I have to have a secret identity so I can protect people I care about. Or if you don't have that, then the whole issue has to be Superman doing, or the hero doing stuff. You can't have any street level, just him interacting with other people. It has to be that character just punching the bad guy for 32 pages. So, but what I think is odd is we were just talking about FF. I mean, as many secret secret identities there are in Marvel, Marvel started out with the FF like, no, there's no secret identity. I am Mr. Fantastic. This is the Human Torch. And then everybody else after that needed secret identities. So that's another thing I liked about FF. Yeah.
Well, remind me to discuss this with you off mic, Tim, later on. Okay. Because there's a side tangent here that I'm not going to get into right now.
Well, Kirk,
was anybody else tired by the Marina going feral storyline again?
It was a little. And her new costume didn't last long, did it?
No, it's all ripped up.
That's right. It does rip off. I hadn't caught that. You're right. When she comes out of the water, it's already been shredded. But it's that funny. Happens off camera between pages 9 and 11, I guess.
9, yeah, when she's.
I like the coloring of that underground water or underground cave because it mimics the yellow of her body a great deal.
Well, it's supposed to be like bioluminescent, and he does a good job of making it seem like it's some kind of weird, eerie glow. And the same with all his, I think you've never talked about this, but Byrne does a great job of creating his underwater environments very believably. He does a good job of the way the vegetation moves, and you get a sense that it really is deep underwater, and there's a lot of stuff going on. There's bubbles, and there's bits of coral or rock, and he does a good job of creating that environment, and then it becomes almost monochromatic when she's down there, because it is, I'm assuming, it's supposed to be pitch black until she comes up into this kind of grotto or whatever this is that she surmises that she went down very deep, but then came back up, and now she's at sea level again in a cave. And then we don't know what happens. Yep. Something approaches her, and then we cut to our one page with Aurora. And some dramatic.
I didn't get that happening. She was waking up. I thought she was still sitting there on the edge of the bed, quivering after last episode.
That's right.
Last issue's shock. So. I just want to clarify that.
She's still wearing the towel she had in the shower, I think.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Yeah.
Which she's clutching very modestly over to herself.
And then she decides, we don't know, but she's grabbing her hair and she's got a pair of scissors. And she says, do something to reaffirm herself. So she's trying to, she wants to lock away shy, timid, boring Jean Marie forever. So she's making some changes, and we'll see later.
But I love her comment. She says, the glass is clear. Jean Marie is locked away again, but I can feel her fighting to get out. It's like, God, what a struggle. What an image. I love that.
Which is, I think Byrne did a good job of giving all of his Alpha Flight characters something that made them less than just kind of two-dimensional. And I think he tried to do that with Marina, but it just came, it was an interesting idea that she's come from this alien race that was meant to conquer, and something went wrong. So she was basically raised by a human. So she became, nice. And that's about it. I mean, that's her story, is that she goes feral because she has these genetically engineered urges to conquer. And that's really it. That's the only kind of character growth we get for her. And I think once that's kind of resolved, I think she disappears from the book, doesn't she? I can't remember.
This is act two of a three-part movement of the character arc. One was her slashing of Puck in issue two. This is the second act, although we didn't realize it at the time. And then the third act plays out under Roger Stern in the Avengers much later on.
Okay. I probably was not reading that.
Yeah. She was in the Avengers
she became an Avenger.
Issues.
Oh,
well,
so
I would say
sort
no.
Unofficially.
Namor
was the Avenger. Yeah.
And she was his wife.
So she goes back to Namor. I guess I had forgotten that or had read the stories.
Yeah.
I didn't know she went back.
She'll go back. Yeah.
Well, it's to your point, whoever said they were getting tired of it, on page 11, you see when she comes out of the water, Puck's like, oh, no, not again. And I'm sure survivors are thinking the same thing. Like, can we just do this a couple, 10 issues ago?
Except this time, he's not caught unawares. This time, he can see the danger, and he can anticipate and act. So I liked that. And especially when Byrne puts it in his... puts the words in his mouth. Oh, no, not again.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah. Did you notice on pages 14 and 15 that at the top of page 14 and then at the bottom of page 15, you've got Marina and you've got Namor in the two different pictures. But the pose that they're hitting, it's almost the same. Like Marina's just sort of like diving at Puck, who's doing a quick ole and getting out of the way. And then you've got Namor flying in the air, looking down at
bottom of page 15 and the
and the
top
top
of
of
page
page
14.
14. And it's almost the same pose, just drawn male, female, or vice versa.
Okay, I see it. I wouldn't have gone there, but I see it.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that on page 12, when Puck, when he first eludes her, when he kind of jumps away, he says, this is no good. My training is all, and my instincts are all for the offensive.
Yeah, offensive.
I can parry and dodge for all. But he's basically hinting that if he can't, he might hurt her or harm her. It's like, well, I don't see how he has any way that he could, whether she was feral or not, that he has any power to cause her any harm. I don't, unless he has a weapon of some kind, but it's kind of like a Wolverine. He's like, basically I can't lose control.
Yeah.
If it happens, she'll be dead. And that's when he says, I promise Guardian, my killing days are over. And then the Namor comes in, of course, and belts him. I think that would have taken Puck's head off, but,
right.
Well, maybe he didn't
typical Namor,
so
hot-headed, impulsive, act first, think later.
Yeah, just.
Well, I love
just
his dialogue.
Assumes what's happening.
I love the way Byrne writes him. You know, he calls him a ruffian. He says, "You seek to harm the chosen of Namor the First," and then of course we get the Imperius Rex.
I love the image of Marina in that last bottom right corner of 16. With her eyes aglow, even though her face is in shadow.
Yeah.
Great, great foreboding there.
Yeah, he doesn't know.
You know.
And we get no gills on Namor again. That top panel when he's looking at him on the beach. No gills.
Mm.
Hasn't become an issue yet.
Not time for the gills, yeah. No.
If you were a patient in Michael Tu Youngman's doctor's office, and a young lady strode right through the waiting room, past all the waiting patients, and walks in on Sarah, the patient that he's treating. We don't see, we do see her just over the shoulder shot there briefly, but nothing is ever made of Sarah or any of those people that she's just so rudely cut in front of.
Mm-hmm.
Very dramatic, but it's like, boy, I would be pissed. I would be saying, get her out of here. I'm paying for your time.
Yeah, she's not. Are you guys reading Sorry, Nigel. Are you guys reading a scan or the actual scan comic?
Mine's reprinted in the trade paperback.
Okay.
And I've got the actual comic.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then, Nigel, on page 18, do you have a coloring mistake on Elizabeth's mouth? Is it just a red blob?
Yeah, it's just a red blob.
Yeah, I don't know if that's supposed to be them trying to color her lips,
it's the
or
lipstick.
If it's just a screw.
Yeah, well, that's what I assumed, that they were trying to put the red on the lips, but it's just like bleh, all over the mouth area. Yeah,
yeah.
Which panel is this? The second panel.
Second panel. Yeah.
Yeah, top right, 18, where he's grabbing her and saying, "It's wonderful to see you," and she's backing away.
Yeah. It's it doesn't exist here in my book.
Yeah,
right.
it must be corrected.
Yeah.
Well, we should say that if you didn't catch our last previous episode, she was on some kind of archaeological dig, and she found a skull, and she had a vision, right? And she's not sure what it is. So, and she's estranged from her father. So now she's and since she was four, she went. That's why she says, "I want to talk to you as shaman," because you basically explain, you know, what's going on. Why did I see? Don't talk to me as a doctor. Talk to me as a medicine man. This is leading into a very important. You know, she becomes a very important character later on, the next six or seven or eight, 10 issues.
I never thought she'd last that long. I thought she was just going to come in for a story and leave.
No, she kind of, if Marina kind of drops out, she kind of replaces her.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, and it just gives, and I don't know if he was trying to get rid of his original, maybe she was going to take over for Shaman, maybe, I don't know. And then we get, you know, this last little bit is with the master skulking about, watching, and he had...
Namor trying to subdue Marina without hurting her.
Exactly.
Which is... Wondering what to do with her,
Yeah, he says he can't, you know, he can't use his full strength.
How do you read the last panel on page 20 when he's got her aloft and she swipes her arm? I would say that she's slashed, clawed his eyes with her fingers, but that's not what the follow-up dialogue on the next page, on 21, says.
No, she secreted some kind of an oil or something, right?
That's what it says. I wonder if there's been some correction there, or somebody in editorial said, you're too close to the line here, Byrne, on the comics code.
Well, I mean, I would think it would be. You've seen that before, where somebody who really can't be harmed is, it's kind of almost like throwing sand at someone's face. You know, you're going to distract him. I have more problem with on that top page 21, the top left, where he says, "My eyes," and he's kind of throwing her off, and he says, "The witch has blinded me." Well, why would he call her a witch? I mean, I know. I mean, it sounds like they're using that to substitute for another word, but why would he? That's his beloved. Why would he? I would think it would be more, "She blinded me," not "The witch has blinded me." So, I thought that was out of character for Namor.
Well, he's never seen her in this state.
True.
This is the first time that he's seen her gone feral, even though we, the reader, have seen her earlier. He didn't enter the series until later on, when she's been captured by the master. And I won't repeat that whole story arc. You can go read it for yourself. But this is the first time, as I recall, that he's seen her as anything other than a docile, quiet, demure consort. So but I'm not surprised that he's got strong words.
Well, it could be if he's angered because of what she did, or whatever, you know, if he's reacting to, because the master says that it's some oil that extreme construction of the pupils. So they're not dilated. They are the opposite, right? So would that blind you?
Right. Well, if they're aggressed all the way down, you're not going to get any light in at all. Effect, you're blind until that wears off.
Yeah. Well, and Namor hasn't. I mean, if you look at timeline, I don't think he has. He and Marina have not known. Doesn't seem like they've known each other for maybe a few weeks, maybe a few months, at best.
Right.
And they're already. He's proposed to her and wants her to marry him and.
It's those fish hormones.
We know Namor is impulsive, if anything. And then the master gives him the Vulcan neck grip and the pinch, and he goes down. And it seems like he's controlling. Maybe he can control Marina because she is not attacking him.
Not yet. She's just kind of crouched there, but I don't think that's established yet.
It's not.
I thought, when I read this, I thought the master was down in the cave. So when she goes, and sees something off panel, but that's him. Except no, he's in surface world clothes and he's on the shore when she comes up.
Yeah.
And he observes the fight and then he enters the arena, so to speak. So I don't think they have been together, but I'm very curious how the master knows so much about oil glands and how on the rest of her species. I mean, it's like, I'll give it to you, Byrne, but that's an awful lot of biology for this guy to know at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, but don't forget when he when he had her captured.
He scanned her, didn't he?
Issue 4, he got her fastened up, and all the machines and everything of the ship, which he is also connected to, were doing all sorts of research and experiments on her. So he probably found out then all about her skin, like secreting oil and such other biological things about her physiology. Yeah. So he knows because he was part of that machine at that time. So everything it found out, he automatically knows as well.
He probably would have known, right?
Yeah.
Were you surprised to see the Master return at this point in the series? I had assumed that he was a done-in-one character at the beginning.
I
see him come back.
I was happy to see him return here because I thought, we never. It's the old thing about we never saw a body or anything and so if you never see a body, it probably means that the bad guy is not dead. Right. But I was wondering, I wonder if he's going to bring him back. And then, yes, here he is. So it's like, oh, okay, I expected he might return sooner or later. Yeah.
Well, I had certainly hoped that he wasn't going to be the prime villain against Alpha Flight for the entire series. He didn't do it for me, but I'm here for the ride, and I'll go for the ride until Byrne finishes his run, and I'm not stuck around for several years afterwards.
Oh, I say,
he never came back again. He comes back much, much later. In another book, but yeah.
We're about an hour in now, folks.
We can move on to. I want to make one comment.
Any last comments?
Yeah, before we move on to on the cover, two comments. One is, Puck seems to be in his costume.
Yeah.
Although he's not in the costume in the book. And the blurb on the cover is, no matter who wins, the good guys lose. Well, I can understand if Marina wins, yes. The good guys lose. But if Namor wins, is that because he's killed her in that way, the good guys? I know it's a kind of a catchy line to get you in and read the book, but
yeah.
I didn't quite understand what he means by because not like they were at odds with Namor. All right, I'm gonna jump into number 16.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, I am covering 16, so sure, I've got it up here. My comic reader sometimes will not. It'll open up two books, but it opens up two of the same thing. All right. This is Alpha Flight, issue 16. Our writer artist is John Byrne. Our inker is, again, Bob Wycheck. Our coloring is Andy Yankus. Lettering is Rick Parker. Editor is Denny O'Neill and Linda Grant, and our editor-in-chief is Jim Shooter. We have a cover date of November 1984 with an on-sale date of August 14th, 1984. 32 pages, 60 cents, or what was it for you, Nigel? Would that be
30p?
All I could find was that Byrne only had one other book at the same time this, and that was FF 272, Cowboys and Idioms. As we've said plenty of times, this is reprinted in Alpha Flight Classics Volume 1 and in the Alpha Flight Omnibus by John Byrne. Our story is called And Forsaking All Others. The Master has abducted Puck and Namor into his Titan submarine. Keeping Namor in a tube that robs him of hydration and Puck in a tube that robs him of oxygen. He explains how he escaped the destruction of his original ship with his vessel that he prepared 5,000 years ago. He forces Puck and Namor to bear witness as he reveals a joint water tanks containing the savage Marina and the twisted inhuman form of her fellow hatchling. Meanwhile, in Moose Jaw, Roger Box has called in Madison Jeffries, a technological transmutator, once scouted by Department H, to help him rebuild the robot Box so he can hunt down Jerome Jackson and Delphine Courtney for revenge. That's issues 11 and 12 we previously covered. That story. And in the Toronto hospital where Heather is recovering from her leg wounds, she agonizes over her husband's death. Logan pays her a visit, and Heather is relieved to see a friendly face. The Master opens a partition between the tanks, allowing Marina and the other to obey their genetic programming and engage in a violent struggle. Or is it? Buck tries to escape to the top of his tube, but fails. While the Master is distracted, Buck uses a mental technique to stop his own heartbeat and feign death, tricking the Master into opening the tube and removing the seemingly dead corpse. Buck springs into action and escapes. Buck then releases Namor from his tube, but Namor desperately needs water. Buck rips the Master's helmet off and hurls it at the glass of Marina's water tank, shattering it. The Master screams in pain. Our two heroes are shocked to learn the helmet was fused to his head and was his means of controlling the ship. As the submarine crashes and a hull breach opens, Namor has to abandon Marina to get Puck to the surface safely before he can go back down. Before he can go back down, the ship explodes. Namor tries to search for Marina afterwards, but only finds the remains of the ship and what he believes to be the other creature. Puck reassures him that Marina is tough and is likely still out there somewhere, and he accepts that there's nothing left to do but return to his people. After Namor leaves, Puck calls out to Marina, who is hiding nearby. She tells him that it wasn't the Master that made her go berserk, it was the other, and she could tell it was made for her to be her mate. She now believes she doesn't belong alongside Namor or humans. She sees herself as a monster and leaves to be on her own. The end.
Good summary.
Thank you. Yeah. I don't know if you would have picked it up, Nigel, but when I the his ship, you know, which looks like a big fish.
Yeah.
I said it looks like something out of Stingray. It looks like something out of Stingray. Yeah.
It's funny. I was going to say, when I first saw that picture, I thought, oh, Stingray.
Yeah.
The Titan Terrafish. Yeah.
Yep. That's why I called it a Titan submarine.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because I was thinking, I'm sure I didn't read that it actually was called the Titan.
No, I just did that. Again, it might be, I'm sure Byrne probably watched that as a kid.
Yeah. I immediately thought, oh, Stingray. Yeah. It's like the Titan Terrorfish. Yeah.
Anything can happen in the next 30 minutes.
Anything can happen in the next half hour. Yeah. Yeah. Used to watch all those. Yeah.
Was that one of the Super Mario animation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jerry Anderson. Yeah, Stingray. Yeah. Yeah.
It was before Thunderbirds. I think it was right before Thunderbirds.
Yeah, yeah. After Fireball XL5 and before Thunderbirds, yeah.
But where does Supercar fit in that progression?
Before that's, Fireball XL5. That's
first, I think Supercar was the first thing he did, right?
There may have been something
early.
Before.
Very early.
There was another one. I don't know whether it was done by them or not, the same people. But my sister used to like it, called Four Feather Falls.
That was him. Yes, that was a Western, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yep. That came first. That was first. That was before Supercar. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because my sister used to like that. She used to tell me, I mean, I didn't really see it for ages, but she used to tell me about it. It was a cowboy, and he had these four magic feathers in his hat, and one allowed his horse to talk, one allowed his dog to talk, and the other two allowed his guns to fire on their own or something like that. Yeah.
I love that Jerry Anderson stuff. I've kind of liked the, when we're off on a tangent here, but when he went to the, like Captain Scarlet and
Joe 90,
when he went to the smaller, the more proportionate puppets.
Yes. Then they were really, visuals were better. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. I mean, I like Thunderbirds. I like Thunderbirds because of the design, all the vehicles and all the stuff is great. That's what I liked about Stingray too. Stingray was pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this is kind of other than the Matt, well, we got two interludes here, but it's mostly the conclusion to the Marina story and the master.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're on this big fish. You know, it looks kind of like, you know,
mechanical
could also be
fish.
Kind of similar to the Nautilus from 20,000 Leagues.
Yeah.
Or an Atlantean ship. They have at times drawn Atlantean ships with this same
fish.
Yeah, fish theme.
That may be, yeah.
I love the cover. I'm struggling. I want to say that it's a purple cover, but in fact, it's not.
It's a yellow.
Yeah.
It's mainly yellow in the background.
Yellow and green.
Very much a scene, an interior scene with a lot of action. And I love seeing Puck in mid-blow, in mid-tumble. I mean, the master is getting his on the cover. Yay!
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I like this one better than the last one.
Oh, no.
I'm not sure why.
I think I like the other one better. The 15.
Again, the Puck is in his costume on the cover, and he's not in his costume in the story.
No.
Well, that's a good point. I didn't catch that.
They do that just for recognition, don't they?
I guess so.
But the other thing was, I wasn't too sure that it was Byrne at first glance. I know if you look at it for long enough, you can see the Byrne in the picture. But I don't know, there were just certain things about Namor, for example, there in the background didn't look quite right. And I can't find Byrne's signature, which is usually on the covers. I don't see it anywhere.
I don't see it either, unless it's hidden by the... On my cover, I've got the Spider-Man head where the UPC logo would be.
Yeah, I'm looking up. Yeah. I don't see anything either. That's interesting.
Well, the master also looks...
Yeah, a little Nigel, off.
He does look off. He looks younger. To me, he looks too young.
He looks taller.
He does look taller. And I think that's maybe the... Right, his torso almost looks too long. Or his head is almost too... because I think you lose his shoulder because of the way the cape kind of comes out of this
big collar
thing that he has.
But in fact, I noticed not on every page, but as we said, starting with last issue, Bob Wiercik was the finisher, the inker. Now, issue 15, though, that I've just been doing, the artwork still looked very much like the Byrne of before. But in this, there are certain pages, but not all of them, where I thought things were a little off. The first time I thought, ooh, was on page 4, about in the middle panel, where Namor's inside his tube and the master's talking to him. Namor doesn't look very well finished off at all.
He's being dehydrated. If you go back to page 2, he doesn't look right in the second panel where there's a close-up either.
He looks a bit drawn there. But
I'll buy that.
No pun intended. But
when you get down to the bottom of page 5, he looks much more restored and more human.
It still doesn't look quite right for Byrne, that.
Right. I think this is the impact of the artist. The inker.
The inker, that's what I'm saying, The finishing is certainly, you can tell the difference. But then you go to the next few pages, like with Roger Box and Madison Jeffries, and they look more usual Byrne stuff. And that follows on again until, I don't know, Wolverine on page 10 looks slightly off for Byrne.
I wonder if
he looks too neat and tidy. Yeah.
Why would I know sometimes they play with the credits, but why would Wiecek be called a finisher here and an inker in the previous, unless he did play a little more than just inking. Maybe he was inking rough outlines or rough layouts, possibly.
But that's what I thought. Maybe he was given more to actually do in this one.
Yeah, that's
possible. And it shows.
I
mean, but not on every page, though. Yeah.
No, it's not. And
let's say page 16 is a classical Byrne-looking page, for example.
A lot of the layouts, like the bits with Puck jumping, and certainly that big reveal page, a splash page with the master on 17, where his face is all jacked up because they ripped the helmet off of him. But and also certainly this creature, this thing that, which is very much like the thing because it's searching for the dominant life form that it can sample and then take that form. So in a way it is like the thing. But yeah, I kind of agree with I think with Wolverine, he's not quite stocky enough. He almost just looks short, you know. And Byrne always drew him as being he's a stocky short guy, and in this one he doesn't quite look that way.
Did you have any doubt that it was Logan?
No.
Okay.
I'm just wondering.
Crossed my mind, I began to wonder if she was hallucinating or dreaming, or if this was going to be an impersonator. It doesn't play out that way at all, but that crossed my mind when I first read this. It's like, you know, hang on. She's already had one nightmare where he's been present. So bottom of page 11, who says that Byrne can't draw a baby?
Which image?
A baby monster.
The left or the right?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting the way he's drawn Marina he's got her kind of with a more of a savage face, but he's drawn her like all of her muscles are taut all the time. They're much more pronounced. And I don't know if that's just mean I guess that's signaling that she's more savage.
Well, she basically doesn't do anything but when the partition is removed, she doesn't take a major role in this at all, except Namor pulls her out and throws her out of the ship. And then the next thing we see of her is coming out of the rubble, out of the rocks.
Right.
And she's very passive, but I see what you mean about her. She's very taut. You know, her muscles are drawn, particularly on 11.
Well, the in that page 12, the top, when all you see is they hinted that it's the when he's raised the partition and this amorphous thing has come into her tank with the baby head. And it says that there's that the water is like bubbling and almost boiling. It's like a bunch of bubbles. And the master says that their programming is so absolute that they seek to destroy even their own kind if they don't match their own imitative psychonomy. But Puck says, I think there's something else going on in there. They're not, because, you know, with the title of this story is And Forsaking All Others, they're like getting married. So I think
trying to mate.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what she says later. She says it was my mate, which I think what's the odds that if these eggs were sent out in pairs, that they happened to find the that actually survived were her egg and this other egg happens to be. I thought maybe just that, you know, one egg would mate with any other egg in order to create more offspring so they can take over the world. But
That's how I read it.
Yeah.
That it wasn't an individual mated, but that she's female and it is male.
Exactly.
And so they're drawn together, except she's now been tainted with human DNA, human experiences. Mm-hmm. And so it's lashing out.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I took it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think later, that's not in Byrne's run, but I think later it's revealed that she is actually pregnant, right? And she has Or does she have Namor's? Or does she have Namor's child?
No, it can't be. I remember that. Child.
That's right.
I don't remember that, but I don't remember that.
It's got to be in the Avengers.
It's got to be in. It's got to be in the Avengers. Yeah, but I don't remember that. I don't recall her saying she was pregnant. But,
no, later on. That's and like we don't have to accept any of that as canon.
No.
I keep getting that. Anything beyond issue 28, we don't have to accept it. What did you think of the sequence with Box and this mysterious stranger, Madison Jeffries? Mm,
yeah.
I like Madison Jeffries a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I'd forgotten about these three pages that they were in here. Too. Yeah.
I did too. Reading them again, rereading them, I remembered it's like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
This is kind of interesting. Because but I totally blanked him.
Yeah.
Because as I will always later on in the series.
Yeah.
I didn't remember him. And as I've said before, when you get to the tail end of Byrne's run, I won't reveal it. But if you look back, they're all there in that first issue. They're all there in the miniature diagram. And, you know, I never tumbled to that until we started this index series. And I saw that and went, oh, it was all right in front of me.
Well, it seems like. Go ahead, Nigel. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I was thinking, you know, why did he wait so long to introduce Madison Jeffries just before he actually finished doing the run on, but I'd forgotten this issue with these three pages.
Yeah.
So we do see Madison Jeffries before I thought we did originally.
Well, it seems that Jeffries was maybe tried out for, obviously he knew Mac and maybe he was interviewed or tested and either he chose not to join. I guess at this point he would be Beta Flight, or he washed out. I mean, he says he just pushes a broom. He's not using his powers for anything. And even is pretending that he doesn't have powers until Box throws all the junk at him and he's kind of forced to turn it into an arm.
He's forced to at least shield himself from the onslaught. Yeah. And then when he realizes he's been exposed, I don't know. So part of this, as I read it originally, I just rejected it. It was like, what is going on? I don't buy this. What? I just put it out of my mind until later on when it all pays off. But it's like, oh my God, this is so cool now to look at it.
And he's the one. I guess this is skipping ahead a little bit, but well, I won't talk about it. I mean, he does help. No. He does help Box with the robot.
Yeah,
I'll say
later
that.
On.
He does. And it also in this that Box wants to. He wants to get revenge on Jerry Jackson and Delphine Courtney. So he doesn't know that Jackson is dead.
I guess he wasn't there.
He wasn't there, but you know, because so he didn't. I guess nobody told him that. You know, with the feedback or whatever, they killed Guardian. He knows Guardian's dead, but he knows how, I guess he knows how he died. He doesn't know that the feedback, I guess, killed Jackson and that, you know, Delphine did apparently escape. And we'll find out more about her later.
That he wants revenge on all of Omega Flight. Am I misreading this?
But he just mentions those two. He doesn't mention Smart Aleck or Wildchild or the rest. So, I think it's because they took his robot and misused him.
Yeah.
And
they used it
for, you know, to kill. That's why he's, you know, he's. And I don't remember now how, I think it's explained later how Jeffries helps him with the robot. But.
By constructing this arm, I don't know if Box is missing an arm at this point, but.
I don't know who
created, but it's like it's pretty clear that he's going to help fashion something. And at this point, I'm real nervous about Box and his motivations. By the time this vignette comes to an end, I'm getting a little bit nervous because that's pretty ominous to say, you know.
Well, he basically,
I don't know
he
how
says
they
he's going
to escape, but I'm going to destroy them.
Yeah,
I mean, that's pretty ominous.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's TV speak and comic book speak for he's going to kill them. I mean, he doesn't.
Yeah.
He's wanting revenge on them, which I can understand. But the thing about Jeffries is, I know it's kind of revealed later what he can do, but he basically says he can. He's a transmutator, which means
made up word.
I can make any machine, any metal, glass, or plastic duplicate my own parts. So it sounds like that's all he can do. But I thought he could manipulate just machinery to do whatever he wanted, not just say duplicate like body parts or things like that. So maybe with training he can do more.
Well, he was in Gamma Flight. He was never promoted to Beta, as I recall, as I read this.
Right.
And so he was never really fully, when Department H was released, they were all cut loose. He was never really developed. Some of them were advancing. We know Puck and Marina were in Beta and that they, by accident, were advanced into Alpha. I think Box was in Beta.
Yeah, because he was wanting to move up before the funding got cut.
So I kind of get the impression that the more sinister or the more brutal, what's the word I want, brawly, the more uncooperative or surly elements were all in Gamma Flight, and the more struggling for the words here, the more peaceful or the more beneficial, the more. What's the word that I want? The good
yeah,
ones gravitate to Alpha Flight,
developed. Up,
and the bad ones stay down in Gamma. And then ultimately, the worst of the worst are corrupted, as we've seen by Courtney with the emotion shifter or whatever you want, the influencer. They form Omega. So that's my interpretation.
Yeah.
So the fact that Jeffries was not moved up, I'm suspicious of that because he looks like a brawler. He looks pretty dark here.
He looks very boxed. Yeah, he looks very blue collar. I don't think if he doesn't move up is because he probably had a bad attitude and did want to be a hero. Because he says so himself. He says, so Guardian, and you see how they spelled Guardian? And they're trying to emphasize his accent. It's G-U-A-R-D-E-E-N.
Guardian.
Yeah. Finally bought the farm. Yeah. He says, I can't be surprised he never was cut out for the hero game.
Oh,
and earlier, Heather says the same thing. They're emphasizing that Mac was not really cut out, and he didn't really want to be the leader. He kind of was forced on him. He took it. But he didn't really want to be a superhero. He just kind of wanted to tinker in his. He said he just wanted to tinker in his lab. So I think that we're emphasizing that maybe that's what got him killed. That he wasn't cut out to be the hero and didn't want to be the hero really. I like Jeffries later when he shows back up in the book and other things. I don't know. I think he stays with the book for a while.
Well, again, I think most people will tell you the series ends with 29. So whether he stays or not, I'm sorry to have to keep playing this card, but there may be a character named Madison Jeffries in the subsequent issues, but that's beyond the scope of this podcast. Heather doesn't quite look on model. Her hair's more curly than I recall. I thought it was straighter and longer, but.
Well, yeah, it's sometimes when a character is in profile and it's, maybe somebody, and it's maybe rough layouts, and somebody's finishing whoever. That's where sometimes the face doesn't quite look the same.
Mm.
Mainly where Logan is holding her on middle of page 10, and
yeah.
a little that red panel on page 9, where she's kind of freaking out about, you know, agonizing over how Mac's dead. And I don't know. I can honestly remember how where this goes from this. He's just basically there, kind of just helping her out, and just giving her a. And this is where he also hints that he knows Puck. She said, "Oh, I didn't know you knew him." He said, "Yeah, we almost crossed paths a couple of times when I was with the government, and he was an independent. So I don't know what that meant. I don't know if he worked for some organization or."
Well, that he wasn't a government agent.
Puck was not. No, he was. Maybe maybe he's a mercenary, maybe something like that.
Mm-hmm. Puck has mentioned the affair of the brass bishop in the past, which we know nothing about. But there, you know, there are an awful lot of threads here to develop more if somebody wanted to, or if Byrne wanted to.
Yeah.
I got to point out a comic book trope. You've got a character, they're injured, they're confined to their hospital bed until they recover. But, gee, they're going to speed up the process. They're going to get out of bed and they're going to, you know, get out of this hospital faster than the doctors say that they should. How many times have we seen that play out? And how many times have they gone, oh, I guess I'm not ready?
Well, I don't get the impression she was leaving, but she said she couldn't sleep. So she can't sleep since Max died. So she didn't feel like that's why she's up and about, even though she's not supposed to. And then when Logan comes in, she falls kind of into his arms. And and then, you know, there's another redhead that Logan falls in love with, but can't.
Yeah, I don't think that was by accident.
No.
I think that was planned right from the start.
Yeah.
I
do have a question on Puck when he whatever he does some type of, he has an idea that he's going to, you know, stop his heart rate and something he picked up, he says, in the Orient. And when the master, of course, stupidly opens the tube, you think he would just jettison him. But he says the body is already cold and stiffening. Well, I could get that Puck could possibly slow his heart rate down very, very low and slow his breathing. I don't think he's going to make himself go into rigor mortis and lose all his body temperature. But I guess that's what he does.
Yeah, and all those thought balloons are all in the master's head. Namor can't hear what he's thinking. I mean, we can because we're reading it, but.
Well, I like Namor is still threatening him. He's on the verge of death, and he's. Says, your hours are numbered, Master. Count them upon the fingers of one hand.
Yeah, that's a pretty good threat.
Yeah,
I like
it's boastful. That's Namor. I mean, that's in character. How Puck knows which button to press to open up Namor's tube, I don't know.
I wonder if maybe he saw something.
Could be.
You know, it'd be pretty cool. Byrne didn't do this, but. One is supposed to be dehydrating Namor, and the other one's supposed to be depriving Puck of oxygen. It'd be real interesting to see that the master put them in the wrong tubes. So they switched it. I would love to have seen that. It's like, you know, Namor breaks out. It's like, you screw it up, you jerk.
Well, what he could have done was he could have put Puck in his tube was slowly filling with water. So he was going to suffocate. And then by him getting out, that provides the water for Namor.
Yeah.
Other than the, which I don't, he says in somewhere that this glass is a foot thick. I don't think that helmet that he throws at him would even crack it, wouldn't do anything. I mean, Namor does finish it off, but does crack it.
It's not a portal to the outside, is it? It's Marina's tank.
Yeah.
Right. So.
And he doesn't have super strength, but, you know, it does have a lot of pressure behind it, I assume. So that maybe that would, then Namor just busts it open and that lets her out. And then that's when we, you know, we see the master and his head's all, it's not very bloody, but it's pretty gross. So it's kind of ripped off a layer of skin above his forehead and eyes. And
Yeah, well, however it was attached.
Yeah. And that's
but
what
I think that, you know, that I think that's pretty good. We had assumed that
yeah.
it was just a helmet.
Well, yeah, that's just yeah, it's kind of subverting what you thought. And he says, you know, he says that helmet was, he goes, it wasn't, I didn't wear that helmet out of vanity. That was my control link to the vessel. It was all my, you know, it was joined to me as part of my own flesh. And all I can think is that's going to, you know, that's going to scab over and that's going to be sore.
Now look at the fish ship on 19. It's wincing. It's like, ooh, I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
Well, it says almost as if it was snagged on a great invisible hook. And then it, I don't know, I guess it hits something. And that's where you get a, the thing starts. Yeah, the thing gets out, the monster. And then it starts whipping around and destroying the ship.
And then there's a giant bubble, air bubble. So once again, to quote you, Nigel, no body, nobody's dead.
Nope.
Oh yeah, it's yeah. I never thought for a minute that the master would perish here,
or the monster.
Well, yeah, but they just talk about later. It mentions. Namer thinks he saw like bits of creature. Yeah, ooze and gristle, I take to be the remains of the monster. But yeah, it's not certain.
Nothing for the master, and he calls that out. You know, the master himself is nowhere to be seen, at least not as a recognizable human body. So.
No, he's escaped again.
Yeah, which you know, you think.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this. I don't know if this creature comes back. I don't know if it comes back even in later issues. I know it doesn't with Byrne.
I don't recall it.
Not under Byrne.
No.
Not under Byrne, but I'm thinking there's a whole lot out in that elf in the Avengers story that we should maybe not for this series of podcasts, but somebody should go read. I think that
will help. I've got them all, those Avengers at that time. So, and I don't recall the creature showing up again.
Okay.
It was a plot device to get her to leave the team. And the fact that you said she shows up in Namor again, at least gives me a little hope that he had, or somebody had an idea, because I was going to ask you guys, how'd you feel about Namor coming in? He kind of comes in briefly for a couple issues. Has this little thing with Marina, and then he's gone. It's just he goes back to Atlantis. She goes off on her own, and that's it. You know, did you think he just wanted to draw Namor? That's why he included him in this issue, or
no? I think this was all the intent from the beginning. I think, as I say, that this is Act Two,
it was a plan,
three acts, and I think Byrne. Not Byrne, Stern's arc over in the Avengers. I was very surprised when they introduced him and then gave him membership. And I look at that and it's like, where are you going with this, Stern? And then it's pretty clear that Marina is the mechanism to get him out of the Avengers. That's the completion of Stern's arc there. And that was always intended that at least under Stern, that was the mechanism that he had in mind right from the start of how that character arc was going to develop. And I realize that's we're kind of spoiling things here, looking down the future, but I think it's pretty clear. Now, whether Stern and Byrne were having coffee and we're talking about it and that he said, hey, do you mind if I use your ideas? I've never heard anything that says that they consulted, but they're such tight friends.
I'm going to say they probably did.
I can't imagine that they didn't have a conversation, that he didn't know where this was going to go.
They probably planned that,
Well, any final thoughts on issue 16?
I do like the last two pages. I like the last two pages a great deal. I can't remember in the original book how these are spaced or if there's an ad page that faces one of these.
There is, yeah.
21 and 22.
There's a page between 21 and 22. It's just a bullpen bulletins page.
Okay. But then that acts as a story beat. And then when you turn the page on to 22, to hear Puck say, okay, you can come out now, that just, I was like so blown away by that. That was so cool. It's like, yes, oh, I like how that played. I really thought that was a masterstroke. Did I lose the audio there for a second?
No.
Just a half a second or something. Yeah. It went a bit funny.
And that image of Puck when he says, all right, you can come out, that looks a little rough too. So I'm wondering if you notice at the bottom, it says next issue, Dreams Die Hard, guest star on the X-Men, it says be here in 14 days. So if Byrne was having to do a issue not having as much time, maybe he did more in some panels, rougher layouts. Yeah. And let Wycheck finish it for him while he was working ahead on this other issue.
Yeah.
Well, the next issue is going to be much more, much more X-Men intensive. And there's, I won't say that there's flashbacks throughout them, but there are flashbacks in a lot of it.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot more work involved in the next issue.
I was going to say after the final page of the story, the next page was the letters page, and at the bottom of that it said that the next issue would be coming in 2 weeks' time, and then it said, "That's right, folks, Alpha Flight is being moved on the schedule, and issue 17 will appear in the second week of the month instead of the fourth." So that's why. There was only 14 days to go.
That might be why.
And then the final page of the comic, was one of those poster adverts. Guardian is dead. Who will lead Alpha Flight? And Wolverine stood there as if they're suggesting he might become the new leader.
Yeah, I've got that printed.
You got
here.
That? Got that? Yeah.
But Heather's outfit. Tell me the coloring. Is she's wearing a dark green jacket and a lime green pair of pants?
Is that
right? Yeah. Okay, because as I recall, elsewhere, she wears a red outfit, not green. But
I think later on she did have a red jacket like that.
Yeah,
and white pants.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, just peeking ahead, issue 17, Byrne is back to doing his own inking. Wycheck is not involved.
Uh-huh.
Although Terry Austin does ink a few pages, some of the flashback pages.
Maybe it was.
Read the credits. Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves, but when you read the creator credits for 17, there's very clear delineation here and tip of the hat to other creators who's been, what do I want to say, they've been reproduced. But we'll get to that next issue. Let's not take up time
too far ahead.
Right.
All right. Well, I think unless you guys have got anything final to say, I think we've got this covered. We can wrap up.
Yeah.
Kirk, do you want to tell folks how they can reach out and get a hold of us if they want to, if they choose to?
Sure. Probably the easiest way is to get on Facebook and talk to us on the Third Degree Burn Facebook page, although there are a lot of John Byrne fan pages out there, I've discovered, another one being The Genius of John Byrne, and there's a bunch of others, Alpha Flight pages as well. You can see the announcements of this show on those pages as well, as Brian is very good about cross-pollinating and alerting folks when we have another podcast out. So you can find us on Facebook. You can write to us an email on gottagetburned@gmail.com. And the other one, I always have a hard time because I'm not on it. Formerly it's iTunes, and now it's what? Apple Talk?
Apple Podcasts. Podcasts. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the other way that you can find us or communicate with us.
We have had a problem with it populating on iTunes. I know that's an issue with the Two True Freaks website, I believe, that when we upload to our website, it should automatically, if you subscribe, pop, it should automatically send it to your podcast collector, mm-hmm. whatever they call it. You should show up in your iTunes or your podcast. And if for some reason it's not.
It's not, no.
Yeah. So I have an apologies to everybody who's listening. I or Brian have not had a chance to research and correct the problem. Now, when we release it on Facebook, the link I include is to the Choo Choo Freaks website. So you can always click that and go straight to there and listen to it. But if you rely on it automatically downloading to your podcast feed, then you may not get it. You may have to go directly to the website. So apologies for anybody who is missing shows that way.
Write to us and tell us if you're missing shows. We want to know.
Yeah. Or, you know, we want to know for future shows. You know, we try to come up with stuff. We're covering stuff we want to cover, but we would love to hear from fans about something. You know, maybe we're overlooking something that you would like to hear. You know, maybe we're not covering the right things. Maybe more DC, maybe more of his independent stuff. You know, we talked about doing more Next Men, possibly. We are, and this is Halloween season, so we're going to pull the curtain back. So we've re-released a lot of our Halloween shows, and I think we're going to have a Halloween show coming up. We always try to release something in October that kind of ties in with spooky season.
Well, the horror that was beneath Lake Erie here, this two-part show sort of is Halloween ghoulish. So we're trying, folks.
Yep.
Trying to think as we go ahead, there's another double-sized issue that's coming, as I recall, and we're doing these pretty much in pairs, in duos, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, that sort of thing. Is this working for you? Would you rather see us just concentrate on one issue at a time? We're coming up on 2 hours here, so I've enjoyed this discussion. I hope the others have as well. But we'd like to hear from you, lovely listener, about what you think, how this is going.
Yeah.
Any further comments?
No, I would say I think the two issue works because you can get more out, more context out, instead of covering one, issue at a time. Now, to your point, Kirk, when you have a bigger issue, sometimes, like we did cover 12 by itself, because that was a bigger, more important issue. So there are exceptions to the rule, but
yep,
I think the two issue works. It works because you have more to talk about.
Okay.
All right.
So, anybody else have a comment? Otherwise, I'm going to thank the panel. Say goodnight, Tim Elliott.
Good night.
And Nigel Sphinx, thank you for your presentation.
Yes, thank you, and goodbye.
And we've enjoyed it, and we'll see you next episode for Alpha Flight number 17 and 18. Good night.
Now everybody's gone. Good day.
Good day.
Couple of things to share.
This is a
Build-A-Figure. No, not Thanos, but it certainly looks like him. This is going to be the controller.
The controller.
Although I hate his face. And then this, I did not recognize the name. This is a Hydra Stomper.
I haven't
got the one leg, and I don't have the head. And somebody made a reference saying, I'll send you Cap's head too. And I went, what? Why would I want Cap's head? And then they pointed out to me, didn't you watch What If, the first season with Sharon Carter? No. Cap doesn't get the serum, so he has to dress in Iron Man's outfit. Hydra Stomper.
I did see that one.
I didn't know it was called a Hydra Stomper, but I remember him. Yeah, him. Basically, he's kind of the Ironmonger.
So I've got a couple of these things that I've picked up. Yeah. Oh boy, I could. Except for that, I wanted the part, the build a part. That one. I could have lived without this, except he had a part that I wanted. I probably
like the costume though.
I shown you this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Professor. That was probably
you made last that time. One yourself, didn't you?
Female Professor X. Yeah.
This is Professor X, and this is Elena Shaw from Dial of Destiny. So
yeah.
And then you probably know this one.
Yep. I still have that one you sent me.
The bogus name.
Yeah. And then this one, again, it's got the Hydra Stomp. Do you recognize her?
Is that Elena?
Elena Belova.
Elena, yeah. It's not what's her name. It's not.
Yeah, so she appears apparently in the Hawkeye miniseries, which was okay.
She did.
She's the star of the Thunderbolts movie, if you ask me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an ensemble cast. Don't get me wrong, but I would think that those would be in high demand at this point because of that movie. Mm. But
no, that movie didn't do very well.
$9.
That movie didn't do very well. Yeah.
Didn't?
No, I don't think it made. Well, I don't know if you want to call it a flop, but I don't think it made. It didn't make the money they thought it would make.
You want to talk about a flop? Tron?
I haven't seen Tron Ares, but I heard it's not doing well.
I've seen it yet. I want to see it, but.
I haven't
seen it. Well, the original one with. Who was it? Was it Jeff Bridges?
Yeah.
One of the Bridges boys back in the 80s. That was cutting edge technology. And gee, that was interesting. And okay.
But it flopped too.
Did it need a sequel?
That Tron. Well, this is the second sequel because there's Tron Legacy. Yeah.
Tron Legacy was the.
They made that about.
So this was actually the third Tron movie?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh my, I didn't know that.
But the thing is, Tron's not even in this one. There's no. They're treating it like. Tron, the name, is not the name of a guy. It's the name of the world.
Right. It's an umbrella.
Right. And it should be because Tron's not in, and he wasn't really in Legacy that much. He was kind of in it. He's not in this one at all. So I haven't. I saw Legacy when it came out. I wasn't particularly.
Is that Viper?
Is that Viper? Madame Hydra?
Well, it is. It's Madame
Hydra. Yeah, she was known as Viper.
Yeah.
And. To my great surprise, I thought I'd never get the part, but turns out that the missing part that I was looking for was less than 5 miles to the north of me. Somebody was selling this.
It's, Ant-Man? What is that?
It's Goliath.
Goliath.
But again, it's from What If. So, you know, I got the arm that I was missing that I never thought I'd get. So I'm closing in on the parts for the
I don't remember... Goliath in the What If. I don't remember.
Well.
And he was in Ant-Man and the Wasp as.
Paul Rudd.
Lawrence Fishburne. Well, Lawrence Fishburne played Goliath, but he never changed sizes, to my knowledge. I don't think he ever grew or shrank.
Well, frankly, I don't remember a lot of the What If series, except when you get to the end of the series, you suddenly discover that all of the episodes are linked.
Yeah,
by
I saw that. I didn't. I did watch Marvel Zombies when we were in L.A.
I didn't want to
two
watch
weeks
them.
Ago. Yeah, it was. I watched it's four episodes, five episodes.
Yeah,
it was terrible. It was. And I never.
I don't know who greenlighted that concept, except drooling fanboys must have been buying the series or thinking this was cool, so we're going to keep buying more. But every time they put out an issue, I just kept saying, nope, this is getting worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. I don't want to encourage Marvel at all. I never bought a single issue.
No. I bought the original run, and I liked it, the one that Kirkman did. But then, like everything else, this is popular. Let's just milk it till it's dead. And they kept doing it over, you know. I mean, look at what happened with, I don't think it's that bad, but look at the Clone Saga. You know, that started out, and then they like, this is popular. Let's run it for 2 years. And they just kept running that story over, you know, just until I finally had to do something with it. But I think that's what happened to, that's why you got Wolverine. You know, Wolverine showed up in everything because he was popular. Venom, same way. He was in everything because he was super popular.
Well, I think that's what happens when you have the bean counters in charge.
Yeah.
They're only looking at the sales figures. Mm-hmm. And so, death sells? Well, let's do more death. Let's go grim and gritty. And they completely alienated another whole generation of readers. that was coming up because it was too dark, too grim and gritty. That, in my view, that's where Marvel went wrong. They didn't have an editor-in-chief or a publisher who would pull back on the stuff that was hot selling and say, okay, take it easy. Let's nourish some other concepts. That's my view of it. But
that's the same with anything. You know, something's going to be popular. They're going to run into the ground.
Well, they did that with Jaws and all the imitators. So I recently heard of a movie called The Last Shark or The Final Shark. Absolutely terrible.
Have you seen
it? No, I haven't seen anything except the original Jaws. I wouldn't watch any of the rest of them.
I haven't seen the uncut. I've seen the Riff Trax version of it. So they're poking fun at it. But yeah, it's a direct ripoff of Jaws.
Jaws.
I saw the, and I posted some pictures, but when we were in LA, we went to Universal Horror Nights. That's why we were there, because I wanted to see what their horror night in the park was like. It was okay. It was pretty good. But the second day we were there, we were going to come back. They were doing the at the Academy Museum, the Academy Film Museum, they have a Jaws exhibit because Jaws is 50. So let's go. I wanted to go see that. And it's great. It's just props and all this stuff from the movie. And it was pretty cheap. It's going to be there, I think, through middle of next year. So not you, Nigel, but if you're in LA, I'd recommend it. I mean, yeah, if you want to fly in for it, Nigel, go ahead.
No, thanks.
if you're, you know, did you go and see it when they re-released it, Kirk?
The original Jaws? I did not. Waited until it was on cable and then caught it in bits and pieces until I finally understood, you know, the flow of the story.
No, that's
probably true for Jaws 2 and Jaws 3, that they were on cable constantly. So it's like, I'm not going to sit down and watch this. Oh, it's on? What's going on? And I'll watch scene.
They released it. Someone saw it in IMAX about a month ago, and they released it in 3D. And because it's the 50th anniversary, so you could, you know.
Yeah,
it was a nice print. I've got a 4K of it, of the movie, and it's a nice print.
See you're already decorating for the Christmas season there.
No,
Tim.
that's just that. Yeah. That's just my tree topper. I can't hear.
Oh, what is it? What is it?
It's I just haven't put it away.
It's dressed as Santa, but what is it? Oh, it's Yoda.
Yoda. And it's a tree topper. See, it just fits on top of your tree. But I kind of broke it a little bit last time. I have two trees that I put up. I have a Star Trek tree, which has the Enterprise. And then I have my kind of movie tree, which is all my movie ornaments. And that's what Yoda goes on top of that one. My other one has the big Enterprise on top that has lights in it. And it talks to you and plays the theme. And all that. And then my wife has two trees. She has a dog tree and she has a regular tree.
Dog tree.
Yeah. What's all her dog ornaments? Because I get her a dog ornament.
Oh, dog tree. Dog tree.
Dog, yes, D-O-G.
I thought you said dark tree. And what's that?
Well, we do have a creepy
nightmare before Christmas.
We do, right? Downstairs I have we have our Halloween trees up.
Yeah. Oh no.
Well, it's just
interesting sideburn. The dark side of Tim Elliott. Let me take you on the tour as we go through our Christmas and Halloween.
Well, it's just I got it originally. It's just a black tree. It's a black Christmas tree with white lights on it, because when I put all my Star Trek ships on it, it's like at space. So then all the ships are around it. So she just used it for her Halloween
tree. Dark tree. Yeah. Mm.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the 22 Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled B-Y-R-N-E. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's gottagetburned@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the Tutu Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's gottagetburned@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.